everyone. How are you all doing today? It's Thursday, February 10th, and you are listening to Against the Current, brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM's News Collective. We aim to bring you an alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and Lower Mainland every Thursday at 3 p.m. We're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. It's here again, folks, and we're so sad to see it go. It's the last day of Fungi programming here at CITR, and we hope you have enjoyed all of our Fungi shows put on by our lovely programmers. And if you would like to donate to CITR or to our show, please visit citr.ca/donate. Every amount is extremely valuable to us. I became part of CITR last year and have absolutely loved my journey so far. I barely knew anything about making radio before I joined CITR, but I was able to receive production and technical trainings that are offered here at CITR for free, and now I'm able to produce, host, edit, and even go in the studios to use some of the professional equipment like mics and soundboards. And I just learned so much, and it's so, so cool to me, but I would not have done any of this without your donations. So I thank all of you for all of your generous support throughout the years, and hope you can keep supporting our lovely volunteer-run radio station. Also, we're offering some really cool swag. If you donate to Against the Current specifically, you might get a chance to be a guest on our show, which is so exciting because we would love to meet our super cool listeners. Oh, and we're also offering super cool CITR swag, such as for $30 or $5 a month donation, you will get a keychain. For $60 or $10 a month, you will get a t-shirt or a tote bag and a keychain. And for $1,000 or $80 a month, you will get a chance to host your own show and get recognized on our donor wall and get everything else on the swag list. How cool is that? So to donate, please visit citr.ca/donate. So for today's episode here at Against the Current, we are bringing you Black History Month programming. As you may know, February is Black History Month, and we wanted to highlight again one of the very special exhibitions that are on right now at the Museum of Anthropology called Sankofa, African Roots, Canadian Roots. One of our awesome volunteers, Tiffany, talked to Nuno Porto, one of the curators of the exhibition, back in November, but unfortunately, we did not get to air the full interview, so we just wanted to take some time this week, during Black History Month, to highlight this important exhibition and interview once again. And if you folks get a chance, please visit the exhibition. It is on until March 27th at the Museum of Anthropology at UBC. And here's the interview, folks.
So just to give the listener an idea, would you like to start by introducing the exhibit? Like walk us through the different stations and what you can find, what artifacts are there in each station as you walked through the exhibit?
Sure. Before going to that, maybe I would like to say that Sankofa, African Roots, Canadian Roots, is co-curated by myself as the responsible for the African and South American collections at the Museum of Anthropology, and by two other co-curators. One is Naya Lewis. She's the founder of Black Arts Vancouver, a festival in Gastown, for a couple of years now, and she's also an MFA candidate at UFT in Toronto, and by Titi Lopez-Salami, who's an artist in the curator in Lagos, Nigeria, and whose PhD candidate at the Department of Art History here at UBC as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a fourth curator who curated one installation, that's Shayo Tayo Olowoake, who curated an installation on twins. So it's very much a collective, or a curatorial collective. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, if we can go into the background a bit if you'd like. Yeah, tell us a bit about how this exhibit came about.
And I was sort of going to your question on the layout of the exhibit and on Sankofa, because it kind of came about very organically from the discussions we were having. We wanted to do a show about Africa, but also about Black Canadians, mainly because there hadn't been any show here at MOA related to Black Canadians. And in fact, in 2013 and 14, we had a show on Black Cuban artists called Without Masks. A little after that, we had another show called Figa Picha on contemporary photograph in studio photography in Nairobi, in Kenya. And then in 2018, I began working with members of different African and Black organizations here in Vancouver on this idea of how to bring them to the Museum of Anthropology and how the Museum of Anthropology could serve their agendas and their interests. There isn't a natural relation, if I may express myself in these terms, with collections at the museum. Meaning by this that many of the African communities here in Vancouver and many of Black Canadians, as members of different diasporas and sometimes of double diasporas, they don't necessarily relate to the collections at the museum. So that relationship, if it will exist someday, is something that has to be created. Possibly because, or eventually because, these collections might contribute to their own creative practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in some cases, to relate to their identity, right? Mm-hmm. So a third element to this, and I'll jump into it, because
I can definitely tell, like, there's a lot of collaboration from the ground up, especially because in this exhibit it's not just like historical artifacts that you're showing, it's also mixed with a lot of contemporary artists, both locally and also from Africa as well. I'm just wondering, like, how was the whole process of asking or for collaborations? How do you relationship?
It was sort of in continuation with other things. So this is a bigger step from smaller things that we were doing before, in this sense that we had this meeting in 2018 at the museum in August. There were a number of representatives of African and Black organizations from Vancouver, spearheaded by Hogan-Zales Society, who's a memorial society dedicated to the memory of the neighborhood which was destroyed.
All right, it's at the back end of the museum exhibit, right? The Hogan Alley.
Yeah. Okay. And there will be a tour organized by members of Hogan-Zales Society. But I'll get to that later, because it's important to talk about that. And so this meeting was spearheaded by members of Hogan-Zales Society, but also the Black Students Union of UVC and the African Awareness Initiative, which is a group of African students at UVC as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after that, by chance and by merit, I would say, we together with Ogenzale African Awareness Initiative, the Black Students Union, and Professor David Morton from the History Department, we got a grant project to work with the African collections, and which is called Decolonizing the African Collections and Displays at the Museum of Anthropology. And it's a grant from the PUER program, which is the program for undergraduate research experience at UBC. And so what we did was to work with cohorts of undergraduate students on the African collections and creating re-descriptions for the catalog, which means to re-document the collections, to use African-based scholarship, and to review the ways the museum cataloging, in a way, hides different possibilities for the objects. Just to give you an example, the same object doesn't necessarily to have the same name when it's used by different groups. And so we are bringing that plurality to the catalog. And we are bringing the vernacular names for the objects and that sort of transformation. The majority of the items on display in Sankofa, in the exhibit, were described by students along this project. And so it's a direct result on an exhibition of the work of students.
Hi, this is Saira from the Arts Report. Did you know that it's Fun Drive this week? If you donate to us, you can help keep local and alternative voices on air. And you can help the Arts Report give you your reviews and interviews. And also, don't forget about the ticket giveaways. So please, if you can, go to citr.ca/donate.
Again, going back to the process, I was working with Niall Lewis before because she did, you know, when George Floyd was assassinated last year, we felt the need of having a response to that at the museum. And I proposed to create an end case on Black Lives Matter in Vancouver, which is there still. And on along that process, we also, for the first time, I think, curated a series of events related to Black History Month, which is in Canada, February. And what we come up with instead of Black Histories was a month of Black Her Stories. So it was a very critical and feminist twist. And we had in the Great Hall, the Great Hall was still open. We had Chantal Gibson, one of the artists present in this show, reading from a last book, and a number of other events. And so, again, this collaboration was kind of coming slowly. And then Titi Lopez Alami was at UBC. And so we thought, well, it's a good idea to see what people are doing in this very, very bustling metropolis, which is Lagos, with a very active art world. And she was very kind to put us in contact and to work with us on an exhibit, which is not about, you know, Africa. It's very fragment, very much dedicated to fragments and to single voices, to very particular views of the present, not so much of the past, and definitely not an idea of Africa as, you know, as the overview of a continent where 54 or 56 countries, depends on how you count it, exist. It's of course impossible to, and maybe undesirable to, do this kind of imperial exhibit on Africa. It's not what we're doing. We're just bringing specific voices to a museum platform, and to realize in this process that much of the artwork, either from Vancouver-based Black artists or from artists based in Lagos is capable of entertaining a conversation in the sense that they are about memory. They are about constant, systematic, deliberate erasures of Blackness or Africanness or representation in public life. They are about recentering the history and taking in the agent's hands the narration of experiences. And so it's interesting to realize that in the 21st century, there's this movement towards more localized impacts of the actions that people are doing within universal frameworks, which tend to go beyond the strictures of, well, of a single story, of a dominant narrative, of in a way of a colonial and imperial understanding of the world. And that's, I think, why we at some point choose the term Sankofa, because Sankofa means, it's a proverb that means go back and get it. It's a proverb that means that one should be proud of one's origins, of one's heritage, and to use it in a creative form to think of the future. It's not so much to be proud of the past, to stay in the past. It's the opposite. It's to look to the future. But coming from where I come and using this heritage as a means and as a tool for transforming the future. And so, on the other hand, the term Sankofa as well is being used by a number of organizations all over the world to signify exactly this transformation. Mm-hmm. So it's very much a term that is related to a positive affirmation of Africanness or of Blackness in a given domain. You can have, you know, the Sankofa Center for the History of Africa in a university, but you also have, for instance, in Brazil, the Sankofa Community Alliance for the Neighborhood of specific places and so on. And so we thought, well, Sankofa is a term that has a very localized origin, but in fact, it's very global. Many people, even if they don't speak English, they will understand the term Sankofa coming from where they come from, if they have an African or a Black positioning. And the subtitle for the exhibit, you know, the roots and the roots, and African roots and Canadian roots, was very much inspired by the fact that one relatively common Black experience is to be asked, where are you from? As if you're in Vancouver and you're Black, you could not be from Canada. And so sometimes when people are asked, where are you from? And they say, well, I'm from East Vancouver or from the West End or whatever. They are again re-asked, no, but really, where are you from? Really? And sometimes, you know, their family has been here forever. And then that made us think that there isn't the awareness that even before Canada existed, there was a Black population in the land that afterwards became known as Canada. And in fact, that the erasure, this centering of this population from public life is relatively recent in terms of history. And it has to do with forms where racism conflates with capitalism and specific forms of exploitation. And what we wanted to do was to tell our visitors, well, there is this population, they actually do great things. And it's a bit on your side to educate yourself and to relate to this side of your country, of your city. And that's very much how it progressed.
Man, who even listens to the radio anymore?
What do you mean?
I don't know. It just seems so outdated, archaic, obsolescent.
Oh my god, did you just Google synonyms for outdated? Look, man, I don't know what radio you've been listening to, but you have got to check out CITR.
What's CITR?
Just about the coolest radio station you'll ever listen to. Check this out. They're a nonprofit radio station that's entirely community-run.
Okay, that sounds pretty awesome. You're totally right. Correct. Valid. Indubitable.
Are you trying to say indubitable?
Indubitably.
When it comes to CITR, there are a ton of words that could describe us. But in the end, we're local, independent, and alternative. Help keep us running by donating at citr.ca/donate.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you said about deliberately presenting a fragmented and localized story instead of, you know, unified imperial story of like Africa. From my impression when I walked through the exhibit, it seems like, of course, like you can't focus on each and single region, but it seems like most attention has been focused on Nigeria, Ghana, and Ethiopia, and sometimes Central America. I'm just wondering, are there any specific reasons of picking these places?
Yes, but maybe not in the way you are framing them, except, of course, there is a dominance, materially speaking, of items from Nigeria, but from different cultures in Nigeria. And the reason for that is, of course, that we had two Nigerian, Shayo Taiolo Owake and Titi Lopez Salami are both Nigerian, and they're actually both Yoruba. So there's that. There's the fact that Nigeria is a huge country with a gigantic population, which as a consequence is one of the countries that has more migrants in Canada and everywhere in the world, to be honest. But the point of having those countries that you mentioned is an exercise in of recreating, of decentering a prototypical image of Africa. So what you practically don't see in this exhibit is masks and drums. And what you have as ideas which present Africa is at the entrance immediately the notion of wealth. I think we both here in North America and where I come from in Southern Europe, we are bombarded with images of Africa as, equated as poverty. And yes, it's true that poverty exists in Africa, but it's also true that that poverty is historically created by very asymmetrical relations. And it's eventually transitory in the sense that, you know, who knows tomorrow, but the signs are that Africans can distribute wealth as well as anyone else. And so the point was to create an image of Africa based on its wealth and based on its long history. And that's why instead of other tropes, we came to agreement in the idea of talking of old religions, which are global. So we talk about Christianity in Ethiopia for many reasons. One of them is that the Christianity in Ethiopia is related to forms of writing and to a very specific form of alphabetization, of creating literacy. Mm-hmm. Very much as the Adinkra ideographic writing is a form of literacy. Then we talk about Islam, and Islam is again a form of and involves forms of literacy and so on. And we talk about the cult of the Orish, of the religion of the Orishas, which is not exclusive, which means that in many places people practice the cult to the Orish and some other form of religious expression. But just to reinforce the idea that Africa is not a new thing, it has been there for millennia. And like any place that has a long history, like in a bit like humans who have aged, you have good and bad moments, and moments that we wanted to celebrate were, of course, those where these ideas we are talking about were flourishing, and because when they did, they left consequences. And so what you'll see in the exhibit is very much an exercise, is sort of, it's almost an exercise of Sankofatization, of going back to the past and coming to the present and trying to bring forms of looking into the past as useful messages to the future.
Yeah, and I think it's very effective, honestly. Walking through the exhibit. Yeah, honestly, it's very effective because walking through the exhibit, I don't see names of countries. Like, I don't see Nigeria, I don't see Ethiopia, but I see the name of the people group, the language they speak, and the kind of the name of the empire that they once was. So I think that renaming really focused on the people group, the interaction, complex interaction of people group, instead of one stagnant country that we see right now. And also what you said about the wealth of the medieval Africa, when I first walked at the exhibit, the first thing that I saw was the kind of gold currency from the Ashanti, Ashanti Empire. And I think that drove home a very powerful message of, you know, this wealth of African empire that once was.
Hey, it's me. Are you still on for Saturday?
We get it. It's hard being you in Vancouver. Between big city loneliness and emotionally unavailable people, it's hard to put yourself out there without losing your mind and your dignity. Sometimes the hardest part about online dating is weeding out those sizzling hot ruby red flags. Other times, it feels difficult to get anywhere at all. Community Radio will never ghost you because there are plenty of fish at CITR. Help keep our station running by donating to citr.ca/donate.
I want to talk a bit about Christianity in Ethiopia, because it is something that I'm quite interested in. Can you tell me a bit about how, just how global and how powerful Ethiopia was in the early centuries, seen from the eyes of Europeans, per se? Like, how would the Europeans see Ethiopia in the early centuries?
I'm not sure if I can respond to that straightforwardly. It's a very complex question because, you know, when you question Europeans, I would wonder which Europeans, you know, are you referring to? Do you mean the Germans or the people that then became Germans or the Italians or whatever? What I think it's interesting to think about from the perspectives that we tried to bring to the exhibit and to this idea that we are just, you know, opening doors to very small fragments of Africa. One of the things is that if you look at places like Ethiopia, their area of influence was not what we, by looking at the map and identifying a continent, think was erroneously think that that would be their area of influence. Ethiopia was part of a series of relations with the Middle East. And what is interesting, I think, about referring to Christianity in Ethiopia is that it's a specific African form of Christianity.
Solomonic, right?
Yeah. So that's one of the things. Secondly, according to Western chronology, the Ethiopian church and the adoption of Christianity as a state religion comes since the 4th century. There's a number of written texts about Christianity in Ethiopia, as religious text, especially one which is referred to, which is the Karen Gast, which is the story of the saints. It's a form of narration of time and of history based on the life of specific saints. And then one of the relevant things in the process is that because the first king of Ethiopia was the son of the Queen of Sheba and of Queen Solomon, who was an ancestor to Jesus Christ, then it is believed that the state in Ethiopia has a divine sort of origin, right? But what was interesting as well was to think of different forms of cult. And it's not by chance that you have some sound fragments that position the objects that are on display with a specific narrative and with a specific form of movement and of praying. Ethiopia, from the perspective of Christianity and Catholicism in Europe, in the Middle Ages, was very much a land of dream and fantasy, because there was a descendant of Christ in the throne. And so it was a place where Christians would go in pilgrimage and expand or create forms of spreading of Christianity through those kinds of voyages, to those kinds of gatherings. But more recently, Ethiopia was also occupied by the Italians as sort of a late colonial occupation or before Second World War. It was one of the first tests to the existence of the United Nations, which then I think was called the Society of Nations, in terms of establishing and enforcing international agreements. It was a very important, if you follow those things, it was a very important center for jazz music. And one of the religious forms of Ethiopia, which was related to the celebration of the Ras, which then became popularly known as the Rastafari, was crucial to the forms of music and to the forms of belief in Jamaica, with Bob Marley and that kind of genealogy. So, yeah, there's a lot into that, but we are not talking about all those things. We try to speak a bit of Africa outside of Africa because, of course, of the diasporas, and because we had some elements in the museum collections which allowed us to remind our visitors that one of the reasons why there are Black communities all over the world has to do with the infamous moment of the slave trade, where enslaved Africans were transported to other parts of the world within the plantation economy, which still exists today to some extent. But we tried to see a positive outcome of that, which is the fact that African forms of expression are embedded worldwide in culture and in society. And places like Brazil, for instance, which is more familiar to me, which has over 200 million of inhabitants, of which more than half identify as descendants either of African or of indigenous peoples or of a mixture. They don't really identify themselves as Europeans or descendants exclusively from Europeans. And of course, the sounds that you have in forms of praying to the Oris have migrated to dominant forms like the samba music and many of the rhythms, which not that long ago were not authorized, for instance, to be broadcasted on radio, because they were seen by the dominant white population, politically dominant, not numerically, they were seen as signs of the devil and that sort of thing, slowly became, you know, the symbol of the country, which is interesting, and it's very relevant. And so we use that those elements to, you know, remind people that there was an Holocaust with the slave trade that brought millions of enslaved Africans to the Caribbean and to South America, and then to North America as well. And that these people afterwards migrated to other parts. And so there were first diasporas and second diasporas and so on and so forth. And we are not insisting in the slave trade as such, because that would be, I think, another exhibit. But we wanted to leave that note. And interestingly enough, we had a number of elements in the exhibition, which again are not the African items that you have in mind in terms of the prototype, because it so happens that the museum is a very growing, and I hope to develop it even more, a growing collection of African painting. And it so happens that this painting refers to the cult of the Oris and refers to slave trade. And so, you know, I think it's interesting when you walk into the gallery, you have sort of a division between contemporary things and then the paintings and the cult objects for the Oris and those things, because they're very modern. They are very popular paintings and very strong. They're actually very beautiful as well. Mm-hmm. And some of them even are done by the traditional methods of tie-dye and batik, which you can see in the Adiri fabrics and more industrial contemporary clothing. Mm-hmm. And so again, you have this sort of Sankofatization of materials. They're always looking back and forth.
Hey, what's wrong?
I just got dumped.
Aw, don't worry. There are plenty other fish in the sea. Plus, do you know who's single? CITR, and they're looking for love this fun drive season.
Really? Is that the radio station that airs Therapy Hour every other Tuesday at 6 p.m.?
Yeah, it is. Therapy Hour is looking for at least 5 donations from listeners this Valentine's Day. So if you wanted to be flirty, you could donate in their name.
But I'm really shy. I don't know if they'll like me.
Don't be shy. Plus, you gotta act quickly because Fun Drive is only taking place from the 3rd to the 11th of February.
Oh, okay. How do I donate?
Visit CITR.ca/donate.
Okay, I'm grabbing my wallet now.
That's hot.
Yeah, speaking of the clothing, the material at the center, I find it really interesting how like different ranks of people wear different things to signal their wealth and, you know, their political ideological message. One thing that I find really interesting, it's like how one of the clothing literally translates to like, I am intelligent. And apparently it's a response to, you know, people thinking that women are not intelligent. Yeah, tell me more about, you know, the story behind this.
Yeah, well, it's it's a form. There are many forms to identify the patterns. And of course, to do a specific pattern in fabrics which are either dyed or woven such as in specific forms, it's a skill, it's a form of knowledge. And so to in a way, I'm using brackets here, to catalog different patterns. Different patterns have names. And sometimes, as in that case, it's a pattern that it's made by women. And it's a response, it's known as a response to a rather offensive classification of women in that area as having small brains and therefore not being quite capable of anything. And not only they are capable of creating beautiful things, but they also are capable of creating the irony of classifying those beautiful things as a response to others. But just as a reminder, when you enter the gallery, the Auden Gallery, where Sankofa is installed, you have that big wall, but with the graffiti, but also in front there's a kente cloth, which is being worn by a dignitary, right? It's the Museum of Anthropology used to have a focus on textiles. Maybe people don't know this, but it's part of the history of the institution. And that kente was collected before the 1950s. So it's a relatively ancient and venerable piece. And it's, you know, it's very well mounted in the sense that it gives you the sense of someone of high rank, like a traditional Ashanti chief is welcoming you to the space. That kind of kente is known as the gold rule, and it's supposed to be extremely rare. And of course, it's not something that a commoner would wear because it's not for commons. It's for, you know, the chiefs, the aristocracy. The and so you have that very objective translation of hierarchy in the case of the kente, as you have in the other fabrics, the translations of locality and sometimes of gender. If we go to the left, to the Islamic section, you also have absolutely dazzling agbadas or the tunics, which are extremely complex to make because they are the result of a number of stripes that create the fabric. And then there's an embroidery, which is also made by men, which takes months, if not years, to be executed, and which is a symbol of protection, which means that when the person is wearing the tunic, is being protected at the same time. It's like wearing a talisman. And so it's very poetic, the whole thing. It's not like, you know, dropping some clothes on the body and let's go to class or something. It's really a preparation of oneself to be in relation to others. And that gives an idea as well that all these elements are used in societies and by persons who think of society as being a very relational thing, which again is one of the millennial proverbs that Maya Lewis has written in the vinyl section of the show, where she writes, "I am because you are because they were," which is very poetic and very beautiful. And it's a statement that we live in relation to others. We don't exist as you know, single individuals.
Hi, it's Nardwar, the human serviette, from CITR Radio. Please donate to the fund drive and keep on washing your hands in the free world and donate.
Right, I'm just curious about the fabrics and technologies. Were they locally produced, or were there a lot of international trade with, I guess, the Arab world or other larger empires?
What do you mean, contemporarily?
In the past with the fabric and technology.
Oh, no, this still exists. I mean, this all these kinds of empires and these kinds of trading and this division of labor of who does what, it's something which is practiced today. Mm-hmm. It's not something, you know, of the past. Of course, today it occurs differently, mm-hmm. But you still have in international networks, you still have the local networks very much present.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go into that, but you know, it's there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess. Yeah. Before we end, I just want to ask about, you know, the exhibit's going to run till March.
March 27, yes.
Is it a relatively short exhibit period with just 5 months, or is it regular?
Well, we are still at UBC and in Vancouver and in many parts of the world. We are still under the influence of COVID. I would, you know, easily claim that the most difficult part of this exhibit was actually doing it in COVID mode, because it's exhibit mounting is a very collective endeavor. It brings together, you know, designers, the graphic designer, technicians of different sorts, advisors of different nature, and you know, sometimes small problems which could take like 5 minutes to be solved on a normal mm-hmm. working environment may take 24 emails in 2 days to get to a conclusion. That was really difficult. And I think the initial idea for the exhibit was to run between October and March, but we came to realize at some point that the furnishers of things that we need to mount the exhibits were not working with the usual deadlines. And so we wanted to have some comfort and some certainty about the possibility of opening the exhibit in due time. And so yeah, I think it's a good beginning. I mean, I think it's a good run. We are doing guided tours, curated tours to the exhibit every Saturday at 3 p.m. And we begin again in January with new tours. And one of the tours, and that's that links to something we were talking earlier on Hogan's Alley, is going to be led by Stephanie Allen, who's one of the members of the direction of Hogan's Alley Society, because the City Hall of Vancouver is negotiating the possibility of offering space in the planification of the Northeast False Creek development plan to install a Black Canadian and African cultural center where Hogan's Alley used to be before it was destroyed by the construction of the Dunsmuir and Georgia Viaduct. And so this is not only about the past, it's very much about ongoing conversations. Mm-hmm. And we hope that by attending the exhibit, our visitors might realize that this flow of history and these conversations are ongoing, and maybe that we should take a position in regards to these decisions.
Okay. Yeah, thank you
You're very welcome.
So that's our show today, folks. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Against the Current by CITR News, and we're here every Thursday at 3 p.m. bringing you local news. And stay tuned for more amazing programming. See you next week!